The Ego and His Own by Max Stirner, continued, Cassette 2, Side 1. With the strength of despair, Feuerbach clutches at the total substance of Christianity. Not to throw it away, no, to drag it to himself, to draw it, the long yearned for, ever distant, out of its heaven with a last effort and keep it by him forever. Is not that a clutch of the uttermost despair, a clutch for life or death? And is it not at the same time the Christian yearning and hungering for the other world? The hero wants not to go into the other world, but to draw the other world to him and compel it to become this world. And since then has not all the world, with more or less consciousness, been crying out that this world is the vital point, and heaven must come down on earth and be experienced even here? Let us, in brief, set Feuerbach's theological view and our contradiction over against each other. The essence of man is man's supreme being. Now, by religion, to be sure, the supreme being is called God and regarded as an objective essence. But in truth, it is only man's own essence. And therefore, the turning point of the world's history is that henceforth no longer God, but man, is to appear to man as God. To this we reply, the supreme being is indeed the essence of man. But just because it is his essence and not he himself, it remains quite immaterial whether we see it outside him and view it as God, or find it in him and call it essence of man, or man with a capital M. I am neither God nor man, neither the supreme essence nor my essence. And therefore it is all one in the main whether I think of the essence as in me or outside me. Nay, we really do always think of the Supreme Being as in both kinds of otherworldliness, the inward and outward at once. For the Spirit of God is, according to the Christian view, also our Spirit, and dwells in us. It dwells in heaven and dwells in us. We poor things are just its dwelling. And if Feuerbach goes on to destroy its heavenly dwelling and force it to move to us bag and baggage, then we, its earthly apartments, will be badly overcrowded. But after this digression, which, if we were at all proposing to work by line and level, we should have had to save for later pages in order to avoid repetition, we return to the Spirit's first creation, the Spirit itself. The Spirit is something other than myself. But this other, what is it? 2. The Possessed. Have you ever seen a spirit? No, not I, but my grandmother. Now, you see, it's just so with me, too. I myself haven't seen any, but my grandmother had them running between her feet all sorts of ways, and out of confidence in our grandmother's honesty, we believe in the existence of spirits. But had we no grandfathers then, and did they not shrug their shoulders every time our grandmothers told about their ghosts? Yes, those were unbelieving men who have harmed our good religion much, those rationalists. We shall feel that. What else lies at the bottom of this warm faith in ghosts, if not the faith in the existence of spiritual things in general? And is not this latter itself disastrously unsettled if saucy men of the understanding may disturb the former? The Romanticists were quite conscious what a blow the very belief in God suffered by the laying aside of the belief in spirits or ghosts. And they tried to help us out of the baleful consequences, not only by their reawakened fairy world, but at last, and especially, by the intrusion of a higher world, by their somnambulance of Prevorst, etc. The good believers and fathers of the Church did not suspect that with the belief in ghosts, the foundation of religion was withdrawn, and that since then it had been floating in the air. He who no longer believes in any ghost needs only to travel on consistently in his unbelief to see that there is no separate being at all concealed behind things. No ghost, or, what is naively reckoned as synonymous even in our use of words, no spirit. Spirits exist. Look about in the world and say for yourself whether a spirit does not gaze upon you out of everything. Out of the lovely little flower there speaks to you the spirit of the Creator, who has shaped it so wonderfully. The stars proclaim the spirit that established their order. From the mountaintops a spirit of sublimity breathes down. Out of the waters a spirit of yearning murmurs up. And out of men, millions of spirits speak. The mountains may sink, the flowers fade, the world of stars fall in ruins, the men die. What matters the wreck of these visible bodies? The spirit, the invisible spirit, abides eternally. Yes, the whole world is haunted. Only is haunted? Nay, it itself walks. It is uncanny through and through. It is the wandering, seeming body of a spirit. It is a spook. What else should a ghost be, then, than an apparent body, but real spirit? Well, the world is empty, is naught, is only glamorous semblance. Its truth is the spirit alone. It is the seeming body of a spirit. Look out, near or far. A ghostly world surrounds you everywhere. You are always having apparitions or visions. Everything that appears to you is only the phantasm of an indwelling spirit, is a ghostly apparition. The world is to you only a world of appearances, behind which the spirit walks. You see spirits. Are you perchance thinking of comparing yourself with the ancients, who saw gods everywhere? Gods, my dear modern, are not spirits. Gods do not degrade the world to a semblance, and do not spiritualize it. But to you, the whole world is spiritualized, and has become an enigmatical ghost. Therefore, do not wonder if you likewise find in yourself nothing but a spook. Is not your body haunted by your spirit? And is not the latter alone the true and real, the former only the transitory naught or a semblance? Are we not all ghosts, uncanny beings that wait for deliverance, to wit, spirits? Since the spirit appeared in the world, since the word became flesh, since then the world has been spiritualized, enchanted, a spook. You have spirit, for you have thoughts. What are your thoughts? Spiritual entities. Not things, then? No, but the spirit of things, the main point in all things, the inmost in them, their idea. Consequently, what you think is not only your thought. On the contrary, it is that in the world which is most real, that which is properly to be called true. It is the truth itself. If I only think truly, I think the truth. I may, to be sure, err with regard to the truth and fail to recognize it, but if I recognize truly, the object of my cognition is the truth. So I suppose you strive at all times to recognize the truth? To me, the truth is sacred. It may well happen that I find a truth incomplete and replace it with a better, but the truth I cannot abrogate. I believe in the truth. Therefore, I search in it. Nothing transcends it. It is eternal. Sacred, eternal, is the truth. It is the sacred, the eternal. But you, who let yourself be filled and led by this sacred thing, are yourself hallowed. Further, the sacred is not for your senses, and you never as a sensual man discover its trace, but for your faith, or, more definitely still, for your spirit. For it itself, you know, is a spiritual thing. A spirit is spirit for the spirit. The sacred is by no means so easily to be set aside as many at present affirm, who no longer take this unsuitable word into their mouths. If even in a single respect I am still upbraided as an egoist, there is left the thought of something else which I should serve more than myself, and which must be to me more important than everything. In short, somewhat in which I should have to seek my true welfare, something sacred. However human this sacred thing may look, though it be the human itself, that does not take away its sacredness, but at most changes it from an unearthly to an earthly sacred thing, from a divine one to a human. Sacred things exist only for the egoist who does not acknowledge himself, the involuntary egoist, for him who is always looking after his own and yet does not count himself as the highest being, who serves only himself and at the same time always thinks he is serving a higher being, who knows nothing higher than himself, and yet is infatuated about something higher. In short, for the egoist who would like not to be an egoist, and abases himself, combats his egoism, but at the same time abases himself only for the sake of being exalted, and therefore of gratifying his egoism. Because he would like to cease to be an egoist, he looks about in heaven and earth for higher beings to serve and sacrifice himself to. But however much he shakes and disciplines himself, in the end he does all for his own sake, and the disreputable egoism will not come off him. On this account I call him the involuntary egoist. His toil and care to get away from himself is nothing but the misunderstood impulse to self-dissolution. If you are bound to your past hour, if you must babble today because you babbled yesterday, if you cannot transform yourself each instant, you feel yourself fettered to slavery and benumbed. Therefore, over each minute of your existence, a fresh minute of the future beckons to you, and developing yourself, you get away from yourself, that is, from the self that was at that moment. As you are at each instant, you are your own creature, and in this very creature, you do not wish to lose yourself, the Creator. You are yourself a higher being than you are, and surpass yourself. But that you are the one who is higher than you, that is, that you are not only creature, but likewise your Creator. Just this, as an involuntary egoist, you fail to recognize. And therefore, the higher essence is to you an alien essence. Every higher essence, such as truth, mankind, and so on, is an essence over us. Alienness is a criterion of the sacred. In everything sacred, there lies something uncanny, strange, such as we are not quite familiar and at home in. What is sacred to me is not my own. And if, for instance, the property of others was not sacred to me, I should look on it as mine, which I should take to myself when occasion offered. Or, on the other side, if I regard the face of the Chinese emperor as sacred, it remains strange to my eye, which I close at its appearance. Why is an incontrovertible mathematical truth, which might even be called eternal according to the common understanding of words, not sacred? Because it is not revealed, or not the revelation of a higher being. If by revealed we understand only the so-called religious truths, we go far astray and entirely fail to recognize the breadth of the concept higher being. Atheists keep up their scoffing at the higher being, which was also honored under the name of the highest or être suprême, and trample in the dust one proof of his existence after another, without noticing that they themselves, out of a need for a higher being, only annihilate the old to make room for a new. Is man, perchance, not a higher essence than an individual man? And must not the truths, rights, and ideas which result from the concept of him be honored and counted sacred as revelations of this very concept? For even though we should abrogate again many a truth that seemed to be made manifest by this concept, yet this would only evince a misunderstanding on our part, without in the least degree harming the sacred concept itself, or taking their sacredness from those truths that must rightly be looked upon as its revelations. Man reaches beyond every individual man, and yet, though he be his essence, is not in fact his essence, which rather would be as single as he, the individual himself, but a general and higher, yes, for atheists, the highest essence. And as the divine revelations were not written down by God with his own hand, but made public through the Lord's instruments, so also the new highest essence does not write out its revelations itself, but lets them come to our knowledge through true men. Only the new essence betrays, in fact, a more spiritual type of conception than the old God, because the latter was still represented in a sort of embodiment or form, while the undimmed spirituality of the new is retained, and no special material body is fancied for it. And withal, it does not lack corporeity, which even takes on a yet more seductive appearance because it looks more natural and mundane, and consists in nothing less than in every bodily man, yes, or outright in humanity, or all men. Thereby the spectralness of the spirit in a seeming body has once again become really solid and popular. Sacred, then, is the highest essence and everything in which this highest essence reveals or will reveal itself. But hallowed are they who recognize this highest essence together with its own, together with its revelations. The sacred hallows in turn its reverer, who by his worship becomes himself a saint, as likewise what he does is saintly, a saintly walk, saintly thoughts and actions, imaginations and aspirations. It is easily understood that the conflict over what is revered as the highest essence can be significant only so long as even the most embittered opponents concede to each other the main point, that there is a highest essence to which worship or service is due. If one should smile compassionately at the whole struggle over a highest essence, as a Christian might at the war of words between a Shiite and a Sunnite, or between a Brahmin and a Buddhist, then the hypothesis of a highest essence would be null in his eyes, and the conflict on this basis an idle play. Whether, then, the one God or the three-in-one, whether the Lutheran God or the être suprême, or not God at all, but man with a capital M, may represent the highest essence, That makes no difference at all for him who denies the highest essence itself. For in his eyes, those servants of a highest essence are, one and all, pious people, the most raging atheist not less than the most faith-filled Christian. In the foremost place of the sacred, then, stands the highest essence and the faith in this essence, our holy faith. The spook. With ghosts, we arrive in the spirit realm, in the realm of essences. What haunts the universe and has its occult, incomprehensible being there is precisely the mysterious spook that we call highest essence. And to get to the bottom of this spook, to comprehend it, to discover reality in it, to prove the existence of God, this task men set to themselves for thousands of years, with the horrible impossibility, the endless Danaid labor of transforming the spook into a non-spook, the unreal into something real, the spirit into an entire and corporeal person. With this, they tormented themselves to death. Behind the existing world, they sought the thing in itself, the essence. Behind the thing, they sought the un-thing. When one looks to the bottom of anything, searches out its essence, one often discovers something quite other than what it seems to be. Honeyed speech and a lying heart, pompous words and beggarly thoughts, and so on. By bringing the essence into prominence, one degrades the hitherto misapprehended appearance to a bare semblance, a deception. The essence of the world, so attractive and splendid, is, for him who looks to the bottom of it, emptiness. Emptiness is, equals, world's essence, world's doings. Now he who is religious does not occupy himself with the deceitful semblance, with the empty appearances, but looks upon the essence, and in the essence has the truth. The essences which are deduced from some appearances are the evil essences, and conversely, from others, the good. The essence of human feeling, for instance, is love. The essence of human will is the good. That of one's thinking, the true, and so on. What at first passed for existence, such as the world and its like, appears now as bare semblance, and the truly existent is much rather the essence, whose realm is filled with gods, spirits, demons, with good or bad essences. Only this inverted world, the world of essences, truly exists now. The human heart may be loveless, but its essence exists. God, who is love. Human thought may wander in error, but its essence, truth, exists. God is truth, and the like. To know and acknowledge essences alone and nothing but essences, that is religion. Its realm is a realm of essences, spooks, and ghosts. The longing to make the spook comprehensible, or to realize nonsense, has brought about a corporeal ghost, a ghost or spirit with a real body, an embodied ghost. How the strongest and most talented Christians have tortured themselves to get a conception of this ghostly apparition. But there always remained the contradiction of two natures, the divine and human, the ghostly and sensual. There remained the most wondrous spook, a thing that was not a thing. Never yet was a ghost more soul-torturing, and no shaman, who pricks himself to raving fury and nerve-lacerating cramps to conjure a ghost, can endure such soul torment as Christians suffered from that most incomprehensible ghost. But through Christ, the truth of the matter had at the same time come to light, that the veritable spirit or ghost is man. The corporeal or embodied spirit is just man. He himself is the ghostly being, and at the same time, the being's appearance and existence. Henceforth, man no longer, in typical cases, shudders at ghosts outside him, but at himself. He is terrified at himself. In the depth of his breast dwells the spirit of sin. Even the faintest thought, and this is itself a spirit, you know, may be a devil, and so forth. The ghost has put on a body, God has become man, but now man is himself the gruesome spook which he seeks to get back of, to exorcise, to fathom, to bring to reality and to speech. Man is spirit. What matter if the body wither, if only the spirit is saved? Everything rests on the spirit, and the spirit's or soul's welfare becomes the exclusive goal. Man has become to himself a ghost, an uncanny spook, to which there is even assigned a distinct seat in the body. Dispute over the seat of the soul, whether in the head, and so forth. You are not to me, and I am not to you, a higher essence. Nevertheless, a higher essence may be hidden in each of us, and call forth a mutual reverence. To take at once the most general, man lives in you and me. If I did not see man in you, what occasion should I have to respect you? To be sure, you are not man and his true and adequate form, but only a mortal veil of his, from which he can withdraw without himself ceasing. But yet, for the present, this general and higher essence is housed in you, and you present before me, because an imperishable spirit has in you assumed a perishable body, so that really your form is only an assumed one, a spirit that appears in you, without being bound to your body and to this particular mode of appearance, therefore a spook. Hence I do not regard you as a higher essence, but only respect that higher essence which walks in you. I respect man in you. The ancients did not observe anything of this sort in their slaves, and the higher essence, man, found as yet little response. To make up for this, they saw in each other ghosts of another sort. The people is a higher essence than an individual, and, like man or the spirit of man, a spirit haunting the individual, the spirit of the people. For this reason, they revered this spirit, and only so far as he served this, or else a spirit related to it, as in the spirit of the family, could the individual appear significant. Only for the sake of the higher essence, the people, was consideration allowed to the member of the people. As you are hallowed to us by man who haunts you, so at every time men have been hallowed by some higher essence or other, like people, family, and such. Only for the sake of a higher essence has anyone been honored from of old. Only as a ghost has he been regarded in the light of a hallowed, a protected, and recognized person. If I cherish you because I hold you dear, because in you my heart finds nourishment, my needs satisfaction, then it is not done for the sake of a higher essence, whose hallowed body you are, not on account of my beholding in you a ghost, an appearing spirit, but from egoistic pleasure. You yourself, with your essence, are valuable to me, for your essence is not a higher one, is not higher and more general than you, is unique, like you yourself, because it is you. But it is not only man that haunts, so does everything. The higher essence, the spirit that walks in everything, is at the same time bound to nothing and only appears in it. Ghosts in every corner. Here would be the place to pass the haunting spirits in review, if they were not to come before us again further on in order to vanish before egoism. Hence, let only a few of them be particularized by way of example, in order to bring us at once to our attitude toward them. Sacred above all is the Holy Spirit, sacred the truth, sacred our right, law, a good cause, majesty, marriage, the common good, order, the fatherland, and so on. Wheels in the head. Man, your head is haunted. You have wheels in your head. You imagine great things and depict to yourself a whole world of gods that has an existence for you, a spirit realm to which you suppose yourself to be called, an ideal that beckons to you. You have a fixed idea. Do not think that I am jesting or speaking figuratively when I regard those persons who cling to the higher, and because the vast majority belongs under this head, almost the whole world of men, as veritable fools, fools in a madhouse. What is it, then, that is called a fixed idea? An idea that has subjected the man to itself. When you recognize, with regard to such a fixed idea, that it is a folly, you shut its slave up in an asylum. And is the truth of the faith, say, which we are not to doubt, the majesty of the people, which we are not to strike at, he who does is guilty of lèse majesté, virtue, against which the censor is not to let a word pass, that morality may be kept pure, are these not fixed ideas? Is not all the stupid chatter of most of our newspapers the babble of fools who suffer from the fixed idea of morality, legality, Christianity, and so forth? And only seem to go about free because the madhouse in which they walk takes in so broad a space? Touch the fixed idea of such a fool, and you will at once have to guard your back against the lunatic's stealthy malice. For these great lunatics are like the little so-called lunatics in this point too, that they assail by stealth him who touches their fixed idea. They first steal his weapon, steal free speech from him, and then they fall upon him with their nails. Every day now lays bare the cowardice and vindictiveness of these maniacs, and the stupid populace hurrahs for their crazy measures. One must read the journals of this period, and must hear the Philistines talk, to get the horrible conviction that one is shut up in a house with fools. Thou shalt not call thy brother a fool, if thou dost, etc. But I do not fear the curse, and I say my brothers are arch-fools. Whether a poor fool of the insane asylum is possessed by the fancy that he is God the Father, Emperor of Japan, the Holy Spirit, or what not, or whether a citizen in comfortable circumstances conceives that it is his mission to be a good Christian, a faithful Protestant, a loyal citizen, a virtuous man, both these are one and the same fixed idea. He who has never tried and dared not to be a good Christian, a faithful Protestant, a virtuous man, and the like, is possessed and prepossessed by faith, virtuousness, etc. Just as the schoolmen philosophized only inside the belief of the Church, as Pope Benedict XIV wrote fat books inside the papist superstition, without ever throwing a doubt upon this belief, as authors fill whole folios on the state without calling in question the fixed idea of the state itself, as our newspapers are crammed with politics because they are conjured into the fancy that man was created to be a political animal, so also subjects vegetate in subjection, virtuous people in virtue, liberals in humanity, without ever putting to these fixed ideas of theirs the searching knife of criticism. Undislodgeable, like a madman's delusion, those thoughts stand on a firm footing, and he who doubts them lays hands on the sacred. Yes, the fixed idea, that is the truly sacred. Is it perchance only people possessed by the devil that meet us? Or do we as often come upon people possessed in the contrary way, possessed by the good, by virtue, morality, the law, or some principle or other? Possessions of the devil are not the only ones. God works on us, and the devil does. The former workings of grace, the latter workings of the devil. Possessed people are set in their opinions. If the word possession displeases you, then call it prepossession. Yes, since the Spirit possesses you, and all inspirations come from it, call it inspiration and enthusiasm. I add that complete enthusiasm, for we cannot stop with the sluggish halfway kind, is called fanaticism. It is precisely among cultured people that fanaticism is at home. For man is cultured so far as he takes an interest in spiritual things, and interest in spiritual things, when it is alive, is and must be fanaticism. It is a fanatical interest in the sacred. Observe our liberals. Look into the Sächsischen Vaterlandsblätter. Hear what Schlosser says. Holbach's company constituted a regular plot against the traditional doctrine and the existing system, and its members were as fanatical on behalf of their unbelief as monks and priests, Jesuits and pietists, Methodists, missionary and Bible societies commonly are for mechanical worship and orthodoxy. Take notice how a moral man behaves, who today often thinks he is through with God and throws off Christianity as a bygone thing. If you ask him whether he has ever doubted that the copulation of brother and sister is incest, that monogamy is the truth of marriage, that filial piety is a sacred duty, then a moral shudder will come over him at the conception of one's being allowed to touch his sister as wife also. And whence this shudder? Because he believes in those moral commandments. This moral faith is deeply rooted in his breast. Much as he rages against the pious Christians, he himself has nevertheless as thoroughly remained a Christian, to wit, a moral Christian. In the form of morality, Christianity holds him a prisoner, and a prisoner under faith. Monogamy is to be something sacred, and he who may live in bigamy is punished as a criminal. He who commits incest suffers as a criminal. Those who are always crying that religion is not to be regarded in the state, and the Jew is to be a citizen equally with the Christian, show themselves in accord with this. Is not this of incest and monogamy a dogma of faith? Touch it, and you will learn by experience how this moral man is a hero of faith, too, not less than Krumacher, not less than Philip II. These fight for the faith of the Church, he for the faith of the state, or the moral laws of the state. For articles of faith both condemn him who acts otherwise than their faith will allow. The brand of crime is stamped upon him, and he may languish in reformatories, in jails. Moral faith is as fanatical as religious faith. They call that liberty of faith, then, when brother and sister, on account of a relation that they should have settled with their conscience, are thrown into prison. But they set a pernicious example. Yes, indeed. Others might have taken the notion that the state had no business to meddle with their relation, and thereupon purity of morals would go to ruin. So then, the religious heroes of faith are zealous for the sacred God, the moral ones for the sacred good. Those who are zealous for something sacred often look very little like each other. How the strictly orthodox or old-style believers differ from the fighters for truth, light, and justice, from the philalethes, the friends of light, the rationalists, and others. And yet, how utterly unessential is this difference? If one buffets single traditional truths, miracles, unlimited power of princes, then the rationalists buffet them too, and only the old-style believers wail. But if one buffets truth itself, he immediately has both, as believers, for opponents. So with moralities. The strict believers are relentless, the clearer heads are more tolerant. But he who attacks morality itself gets both to deal with. Truth, morality, justice, light, etc., are to be and remain sacred. What anyone finds to censure in Christianity is simply supposed to be unchristian, according to the view of these rationalists. But Christianity must remain a fixture. To buffet it is outrageous, an outrage. To be sure, the heretic against pure faith no longer exposes himself to the earlier fury of persecution, but so much the more does it now fall upon the heretic against pure morals. Piety has for a century received so many blows, and had to hear its superhuman essence reviled as an inhuman one so often, that one cannot feel tempted to draw the sword against it again. And yet it has almost always been only moral opponents that have appeared in the arena to assail the supreme essence in favor of another supreme essence. So Proudhon, unabashed, says, "Man is destined to live without religion, but the moral law is eternal and absolute. Who would dare today to attack morality?" Moral people skimmed off the best fat from religion, ate it themselves, and are now having a tough job to get rid of the resulting scrofula. If, therefore, we point out that religion has not by any means been hurt in its inmost part, so long as people reproach it only with its superhuman essence, and that it takes its final appeal to the spirit alone, for God is spirit, then we have sufficiently indicated its final accord with morality, and can leave its stubborn conflict with the latter lying behind us. It is a question of supreme essence with both, and whether this is a superhuman or a human one can make, since it is in any case an essence over me, a super mine one, so to speak, but little difference to me. In the end, the relation to the human essence, or to man, as soon as ever it has shed the snakeskin of the old religion, will yet wear a religious snakeskin again. So Feuerbach instructs us that, if one only inverts speculative philosophy, always makes the predicate the subject, and so makes the subject the object and principle, one has the undraped truth, pure and clean. Herewith, to be sure, we lost the narrow religious standpoint, lost the God, who from this standpoint is subject. But we take in exchange for it the other side of the religious standpoint, the moral standpoint. Thus we no longer say, God is love, but love is divine. If we further put in place of the predicate divine the equivalent sacred, then, as far as concerns the sense, all the old comes back again. According to this, love is to be the good in man, his divineness, that which does him honor, his true humanity. It makes him man for the first time, makes for the first time a man out of him. So then it would be more accurately worded thus. Love is what is human in man, and what is inhuman is the loveless egoist. But precisely all that which Christianity, and with it speculative philosophy, that is, theology, offers as the good, the absolute, is to self-ownership simply not the good, or what means the same, it is only the good. Consequently, by the transformation of the predicate into the subject, the Christian essence, and it is the predicate that contains the essence, you know, would only be fixed yet more oppressively. God and the divine would entwine themselves all the more inextricably with me. To expel God from his heaven and to rob him of his transcendence cannot yet support a claim of complete victory, if therein he is only chased into the human breast and gifted with indelible immanence. Now they say, the divine is the truly human. The same people who oppose Christianity as the basis of the state, who oppose the so-called Christian state, do not tire of repeating that morality is the fundamental pillar of social life and of the state, as if the dominion of morality were not a complete dominion of the sacred, a hierarchy. So we may here mention, by the way, that rationalist movement which, after theologians had long insisted that only faith was capable of grasping religious truths, that only to believers did God reveal himself, and that therefore only the heart, the feelings, the believing fancy was religious, broke out with the assertion that the natural understanding, human reason, was also capable of discerning God. What does that mean but that the reason laid claim to be the same visionary as the fancy? In this sense, Reimarus wrote his Most Notable Truths of Natural Religion. It had come to this, that the whole man with all his faculties was found to be religious, heart and affections, understanding and reason, feeling, knowledge and will. In short, everything in man appeared religious. Hegel has shown that even philosophy is religious. And what is not called religion today? The religion of love, the religion of freedom, political religion, in short, every enthusiasm. So it is, too, in fact. To this day, we use the Romance word religion, which expresses the concept of a condition of being bound. To be sure, we remain bound, so far as religion takes possession of our inward parts. But is the mind also bound? On the contrary, that is free, is sole lord, is not our mind, but absolute. Therefore, the correct affirmative translation of the word religion would be freedom of mind. In whomsoever the mind is free, he is religious in just the same way as he in whom the senses have free course is called a sensual man. The mind binds the former, the desires the latter. Religion, therefore, is boundness or religio with reference to me. I am bound. It is freedom with reference to the mind. The mind is free, or has freedom of mind. Many know from experience how hard it is on us when the desires run away with us, free and unbridled, but that the free mind, splendid intellectuality, enthusiasm for intellectual interests, or however this jewel may in the most various phrase be named, brings us into yet more grievous straits than even the wildest impropriety, people will not perceive, nor can they perceive it without being consciously egoists. Reimarus and all who have shown that our reason, our heart, etc., also lead to God, have therewithal shown that we are possessed through and through. To be sure, they vexed the theologians, from whom they took away the prerogative of religious exaltation. But for religion, for freedom of mind, they thereby conquered yet more ground. For when the mind is no longer limited to feeling or faith, but also as understanding, reason, and thought in general belongs to itself the mind, when, therefore, it may take part in the spiritual and heavenly truths in the form of understanding, as well as in its other forms, then the whole mind is occupied only with spiritual things, that is, with itself, and is therefore free. Now we are so through and through religious that jurors, sworn men, condemn us to death, and every policeman, as a good Christian, takes us to the lockup by virtue of an oath of office. Morality could not come into opposition with piety till after the time when, in general, the boisterous hate of everything that looked like an order, decrees, commandments, etc., spoke out in revolt, and the personal absolute Lord was scoffed at and persecuted. Consequently, it could arrive at independence only through liberalism, whose first form acquired significance in the world's history as citizenship, and weakened the specifically religious powers. See liberalism below. For when morality not merely goes alongside of piety, but stands on feet of its own, then its principle lies no longer in the divine commandments, but in the law of reason, from which the commandments, so far as they are still to remain valid, must first await justification for their validity. In the law of reason, man determines himself out of himself, For man is rational, and out of the essence of man those laws follow of necessity. Piety and morality part company in this, that the former makes God the lawgiver, the latter man. From a certain standpoint of morality, people reason about as follows. Either man is led by his sensuality, and is, following it, immoral, or he is led by the good, which, taken up into the will, is called moral sentiment, sentiment and prepossession in favor of the good. Then he shows himself moral. From this point of view, how, for instance, can Zonta's assassination of Kotzebue be called immoral? What is commonly understood by unselfish, it certainly was, in the same measure as, among other things, St. Crispin's thievery in favor of the poor. He should not have murdered, for it stands written, "Thou shalt not murder." Then, to serve the good, the welfare of the people, as Zonta at least intended, or the welfare of the poor, like Crispin, is moral. But murder and theft are immoral. The purpose moral, the means immoral. Why? Because murder, assassination, is something absolutely bad. When the guerrillas enticed the enemies of the country into ravines and shot them down unseen from the bushes, do you suppose that was assassination? According to the principle of morality, which commands us to serve the good, you could really ask only whether murder could never in any case be a realization of the good, and would have to endorse that murder which realized the good. You cannot condemn Zonta's deed at all. It was moral, because in the service of the good, because unselfish. It was an act of punishment, which the individual inflicted, an execution inflicted at the risk of the executioner's life. What else had his scheme been, after all, but that he wanted to suppress writings by brute force? Are you not acquainted with the same procedure as a legal and sanctioned one? And what can be objected against it from your principle of morality? But it was an illegal execution. So the immoral thing in it was the illegality, the disobedience to law? Then you admit that the good is nothing else than law? Morality nothing else than loyalty? And to this externality of loyalty your morality must sink, to this righteousness of works in the fulfillment of the law, only that the latter is at once more tyrannical and more revolting than the old-time righteousness of works? For in the latter, only the act is needed. But you require the disposition, too. One must carry in himself the law, the statute, and he who is most legally disposed is the most moral. Even the last vestige of cheerfulness in Catholic life must perish in this Protestant legality. Here at last the domination of the law is for the first time complete. Not I live, but the law lives in me. Thus I have really come so far to be only the vessel of its glory. Every Prussian carries his gendarme in his breast, says a high Prussian officer. Why do certain opposition parties fail to flourish? Solely for the reason that they refuse to forsake the path of morality or legality. Hence the measureless hypocrisy of devotion, love, etc., from whose repulsiveness one may daily get the most thorough nausea at this rotten and hypocritical relation of a lawful opposition. In the moral relation of love and fidelity, a divided or opposed will cannot have place. The beautiful relation is disturbed if the one wills this and the other the reverse. But now, according to the practice hitherto, and the old prejudice of the opposition, the moral relation is to be preserved above all. What is then left to the opposition? Perhaps the will to have a liberty if the beloved one sees fit to deny it? Not a bit. It may not will to have the freedom, it can only wish for it, petition for it, lisp a please, please. What would come of it if the opposition really willed, willed with the full energy of the will? No, it must renounce will in order to live to love, renounce liberty for love of morality. It may never claim as a right what it is permitted only to beg as a favor. Love, devotion, etc., demand with undeviating definiteness that there be only one will to which the others devote themselves, which they serve, follow, love. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.